Most outside critics sympathized, no doubt, with the minority, but it is questionable whether they felt much respect for a religion whose spokesman could differ so fundamentally. Do the churches know their own mind, or even their own minds? That is, in effect, the question which bewilders men today far more than any strictly theological problem. I do not mean that the ordinary Englishman is forever worrying about the question. The sad truth is that he lacks the necessary interest in religious matters altogether. You will only catch occasional glimpses of his attitude, but they are, to my mind, unmistakable. "Let the churches make up their own mind what they believe," he says, "and then come and tell me." Meanwhile, there is no sign that such an event is probable. The present effort to unify belief and practice within the Church of England is the heir to a long line of failures. The Anglo-Catholic Party has a solidarity that is only external. It is based on a compromise, and its unity is that of a party, not that of a creed. This generation will die, and the next, before the churches can present the nation with a common program. We have no precedent by which to forecast the outcome of the present situation. The pulse of religion has beaten low enough in England before now, but there has never, before this last century, been a time at which so many of our fellow countrymen made no response to its movements. In the worst of the latitudinarian days, the embers of belief were kept alive, not smothered, by the ashes of indifference. The Bible was never so little believed as it is today. I doubt if it was ever so little read. The optimism of the religious temperament will continually find new grounds for confidence, will hail local successes, and welcome the suggestion of untried remedies. But there is no sign, yet, of a rally, no distant footfall of the prodigal's return. Organized religion has shrunk, and is still shrinking, at once in the content of its message and in the area of its appeal. 2. The shop window. It so happens that there is one religious body in the country which registers a yearly increase in its membership more than proportionate to the national birth rate. It so happens that there is one religious body in the country which does not alter its message to suit the shifting fashions of human thought, which gives no sign of yielding to modern outcries under the severest pressure from public opinion. It so happens that the body alluded to is in either case the same, the Catholic Church. I'm not instituting a precarious inference from the popularity of my own religion to its truth. No inference is more easy, none is, commonly, more fallacious. I'm simply trying to account for the fact, which is an observable fact to any unprejudiced critic, that the Catholic Church has, at the moment, a readier hearing and a better all-round reception among the mass of Englishmen than it has had since its voice was smothered by persecution, it seemed, finally 250 years ago. In contrast with the general religious conditions which I have attempted to depict in the last chapter, men's attention is directed towards us, either because our pulpits still give forth the same sound, or because our pews are filling instead of emptying, or because a comparison of these two facts seems to them significant. I'm not optimist enough to exaggerate the tendency. I fancy it is still true that the mass of the population thinks of us as something quite off the map, conceives our pomp of yesterday as one with Nineveh and Tyre. But as Catholic churches spring into being all over the country, as Catholic activities demand a larger publicity even from that highly conventional institution, the daily press, we appear to provide the bewildered Englishman sometimes with a criticism, sometimes with a solution, of the religious problems which distract our times. It is difficult to form any idea of the neglect, nay, of the contempt into which the Catholic name had fallen in England toward the end of the 18th century, before the French Revolution, the Oxford conversions, and the Irish immigration had strengthened our position. I do not mean politically. The 45, and memories of the 45, still made us formidable to our fellow countrymen. But Catholicism as an intellectual system seemed, I suppose, no more possible to the Englishman of the 18th century than the principles of the Thug or the Doubtheber. So far removed, was it from the intellectual compass of the age, that those professed it in our country, a particularly hard-headed set of men were assumed to be fanatics, drugged by the influence of some strange wave of religious emotion. It was not conceived possible that calm deliberation, that reasoned calculation, could lead a man to conclusions so unfashionable. In an age which hated enthusiasm, Catholicism was the reductio ad absurdum of enthusiasm, and there is pleasant reading to be found in the magazines of the period, where the early fervors of Wesleyanism are compared to those of popery, and condemned by the comparison. Two Wesleyan preachers, at Brighton, I think, were actually said to have been recognized by passers-by as members of the Society of Jesus. Faded Chloe's and Clorindus, How You Despised Us. In our day, antipathy to Catholicism is still abundantly manifested. Wills are drawn up in which the heir forfeits his rights if he should make his submission to Rome, and when a conversion does take place, at least in those highest and lowest social strata in which prejudice dies hard, it is usually the signal for a chorus of irascible comment. But, when the concrete case does not arise, it is wonderful how much Platonic admiration is shown nowadays for the Catholic system, once so contemned. It is wonderful how often the validity, as the schoolmen say, to become a Catholic is found among highly educated and highly cultivated people. Never, in fact, come near to the point of submission. Allowance must be made for kind-heartedness and natural politeness, but this explanation cannot be accepted as the sole explanation. You hardly ever meet an intelligent person does not admire us for something. He would so like to be a Catholic, he says, for the sake of points A, B, and C in our system. If only points D, E, and F did not interpose an insuperable barrier. And, although such language is often on the lips of men, have never seriously considered whether submission to the Church is, or ever could be, possible for them, there are lives in which the nostalgia for Rome makes tragedy. Such a craving was Florence Nightingale's, such was W. Zauer Bullock's, though indeed he did have a priest at his deathbed. At this moment, without stopping to think of names, I can recall three men of good family and exceptional ability have died, within the last decade or so, outside the Church, although their familiar friends knew that they were longing to become Catholics if they could. Such intellects, like moths singeing their wings round a candle, cannot keep away from the thought of Catholicism, however often it repels them. It drives them away from every other form of religion. As hopeless love for a married woman may keep a man a bachelor, they will not put up with second-best substitutes. There is an attraction about the Catholic Church, not merely for the pigeon-headed, devout, or the paradoxical undergraduate, but for penetrating minds and justly balanced temperaments. I propose in this chapter to disentangle some of the various elements in the appeal of which I have been speaking. I have called it the shop window, because I believe that there is, I will not say a large body of people, but a considerable body of people, whom you may easily liken to a crowd of small boys outside a confectioner's shop, flattening their noses against the pane and feasting, in imagination only, upon the good things they see there, but they have no money to get in. Just so these Platonic admirers, these would-be converts, look longingly towards Catholicism for the satisfaction each of his own need. Now and again, perhaps it notoriously happens in shop windows, mistaking some accidental glory of the Church for a more perfect thing than it is. The elders, in hearing Helen's suit, must needs make allowance for the siren sweetness of her voice. So he undertakes to investigate the claims of the Catholic Church is naturally on his guard, lest his judgment should be biased unconsciously in its favor. At least we shall avoid unconscious bias if, from the outset, we tabulate the various attractions which the Church has for various minds, put them out, as it were, in the shop window, and take a good look at them. They talk of the lure of Rome. In this chapter, at any rate, the net shall be spread honestly in the sight of the bird. Of all the features in the Catholic system which appeal powerfully to men's, Mine's at the present moment, the least, assuredly, is the mere beauty of her external adornment, the merely aesthetic effect of vestments made in art stuffs, or blazing candles, or gold and silver altar furniture, of lace and flowers. Chloe and Clorinda did feel, I think, a sneaking attraction towards these Romish bedizenments, tempered, of course, by a strong moral reprobation. In our day, their appeal is of the slightest, if for no other reason, because these characteristics of her own system are easily imitable, and have been freely imitated. It is, perhaps fortunately, no longer necessary to betake yourself to Catholic churches, in order to glut your senses with artistic appreciation of ceremonial. Our high church friends do it as well or better. Their churches provide, as it were, a mimic Riviera on the soil of home, to suit these sickly temperaments. Mere beauty, mere pageantry, is no speciality of ours, and no appreciable boast. But there is something else underlying the pomp of our ceremonial which makes, I think, a more powerful impression, no one far more difficult to analyze. I mean the sense of mystery. The effect of long distances, of tapers flickering in the heart of an altar far away, of slow silences interrupted by sudden bursts of sound, of voices coming from unseen quarters, of doors opening unexpectedly, of figures moving to and fro over a business unintelligible to the spectator, of long chants in a language which he does not hear or does not understand, of tingling bells and incense smoke caught in the shifting lights, of a high-windowed building. The effect, I say, of all this upon the visitor has no opportunity, and no wish to, follow the service, is to breed an atmosphere of solemn mystery which works, not upon his senses, but upon his imagination. In this respect, Catholic ceremonial does not lend itself so readily to imitation. The intrusion of English, or any other intelligible tongue, breaks the spell of mystery with its too familiar cadences. And yet you will meet with elements of all this in some of the old cathedrals. You'll meet it in King's Chapel, at Cambridge, if you stand outside the screen, and listen to the chanting on the farther side of it. Conversely, in a small and ill-built Catholic church you will miss the illusion. Our crude forefathers had a name for all this. They called it hocus pocus. The moderns, or at least the more religiously disposed among them, have formed a very different judgment. To them this illusion is the sense of worship. It proves, with reasons of the heart, not of the intellect, that man is born for something higher than materialism. This sense of unapproachableness, is it not evidence that there is an unapproachable, whom yet our finite minds must needs labor to approach? I confess that I cannot find it in my heart to agree fully with either criticism. Mystification, mummery for mummery's sake, exasperates me beyond speech, and I have never been able to understand my countrymen's partiality for Masonic and quasi-Masonic ritual. But in Catholic churches the effect is an accidental one. We do not deliberately mystify. On the contrary, our modern tendency encourages the laity to know what is being done, and even, by the aid of translations, to follow what is being said. If anybody prefers to cultivate the sense of mystery, by all means let him. But it is a very tenuous argument that can be derived from the impressions so received, in favor either of Christianity or of Catholicism. From a different angle, the outside observer is apt to conceive of Catholicism as being at least a business-like religion. The ministers of most Christian denominations affect, he finds, a slowness of walk and of movement. While they are in church they talk either in deliberately earnest tones, or in a kind of professional drawl. Their enunciation, their gestures, even the look on their faces, is expressive of unction. Nay, even out of church, he detects or thinks he detects a certain professionalism of manner, a personified air, which repels him. It seems to him that he finds, among the other Christianities, a deliberate attempt to be impressive, and, Britain-like, he suspects unreality behind these calculated demarches. Good wine, he reminds himself, needs no bush, and if there were really any truth behind the doctrines which these teachers profess, they would not be so desperately anxious to parade their conviction of it. Whereas, if he has strayed into a Catholic church, he finds these airs of professionalism absent. There are no unnatural tones in the voice, There is no obtrusive deliberation of manner. The priest goes about his work with the briskness, the matter-of-factness, of a shopkeeper or an operating surgeon. The whole performance seems to be, for the initiated, something quite natural, something which they take for granted. And, though it may all mean to him no more than the liturgy of mumbo-jumbo, he is favorably impressed with the convictions of men and women can thus hold commerce with the other world without inhuman deportment. They seem to know what they are about, these people, is his criticism, and perhaps there is something in it. So far I have been assuming that our inquirer has not been content to learn about the church by hearsay, but has attended Catholic services, if only as part of his experiences during foreign travel. But indeed it is possible, without any first-hand contact, to find your imagination dwelling wistfully on the thought of the Catholic Church. Alone among the Christianities, it is capable of taking rank, even in isolation, as one of the great religions of the world. Take it vertically or horizontally, that is, historically or geographically, it is a vast edifice. Like the Great Pyramid, it will challenge your attention from a distance, and set you wondering, how human workmanship has you suppose it to be, can't spread so wide, and so defy the centuries. Nor is it any megalomania, any spirit of religious jingoism, that makes us long to claim membership in such an institution. To belong to a small sect may have its attractions, may prove a sop to pride, or an incentive to fanaticism. But the normal man, less self-confident in his opinions, asks for company. He would not, if possible, have the whole world disagreeing with him. He will at least envisage the possibility that the majority may be right, though it be beyond the seas, or even beyond the grave. Let us look at the historical character of Catholicism first. It is convenient, no doubt, to call oneself a Christian, and even by a modern metaphor, to call oneself a Catholic, without feeling responsible for the whole cheeky past of Christendom, without making oneself an accessory to the fires of Smithfield, or being tarred with the brush of Torquemada. Happy is the nation, it has been said, which has no past, and the church of yesterday enjoys the advantages which the dictum implies. To be tied to no dead hand of tradition, bowed down by no cumbrous legacies of antiquity, leaves the mind more free for speculation, and the heart for adventure. But in disclaiming the dead, you are yourself disclaimed by the dead. If you are not prepared to blush for Alexander VI, it is childishly inconsistent to take pride in the memory of Saint Francis. You may claim a kind of sentimental connection with the Christianity of earlier ages, but not a historic, not a vital continuity. The fathers of the early church may be your models and your heroes, but they are no genuine part of your ancestry. It is not everybody has a sense of history, I mean, a feeling for our past. Indeed, there is a kind of modern coxcombry which takes delight in belittling the achievements of the human genius by comparing them with the long, vacant centuries which preceded history itself. But it is hard to see how those are accustomed to live in the past, those whose blood is thrilled by a jinchord, those feel the greatness of the classical tradition, can be so incurious as to their own spiritual origins. More and more, I think, as the changing conditions of modern society cut us off from the memory of old things, as customs die out, and property changes hands, and our language loses its virility, and even perhaps, the power of the empire we live in sinks in the scale of political values, men will look towards the Catholic Church, if only as the repository of long traditions, the undying, unmoved spectator of the thousand phases and fashions that have passed over our restless world. I may be wrong, but it seems to me that it is already happening, that the reaction from all this silly worship of the future is predisposing men's minds towards the Catholic claim. And if the longevity of the Church attracts them, its worldwide diffusion has an even greater influence. It is true that Protestant controversialists have made efforts to explain away this geographical universality, insinuating that Catholicism, so far from being the religion of Europe, is only the religion of the Latin races amongst whom, by a slight strain of ethnographical principle, it is necessary to include the Irish, the Poles, and the Hungarians. But the attempt is from the first to desperate one. Holland is two-fifths Catholic, and it was only the First World War, with its consequent territorial adjustments, that prevented the German Empire from showing, as it must have shown in a few more years, a majority of Catholic citizens. All the redistribution of Europe at instance for cells, never conceived in a spirit friendly to Catholic interests, has failed to obscure the fact that Catholicism pervades Europe. Meanwhile, recent events have done much to rob the schismatic Eastern churches of their political solidarity and of their spiritual prestige. Catholicism is admittedly the most successful of the missionary religions, and its growth in the New World is sufficiently attested by the alarm of its ill-wishers. Whoever wishes to find men of his own faith, wherever there are men of his own species, if he does not actually wish to be a Catholic, must at least wish that he were Catholic. But even these glories of the Church are accidental glories. It was not a memorial, it was not worldwide. On the day of Pentecost there is another quality of Catholicism, more intimate and more integral, which at once repels and attracts the men of our generation. I mean the claim of the Church to authority in matters of faith and morals. This claim will, of course, occupy us throughout the present work. It has to be treated here only so far as it is, to some souls, a magnet of attraction which draws them towards the Catholic system. When I say that the people of our time, and especially the young people of our time, want authority, I do not mean that they desire to be controlled by a coercive authority from without, only an ascetic desires that for its own sake. I mean that, in the literal and primitive sense of the word, authority, they want a warrant to authorize them in doing what they do, sanctions to justify them in behaving as they behave. This is, I believe, a characteristic symptom of our age, and very largely a post-war symptom. In normal times, there is no such demand. Decent people, whatever their beliefs, are content to be guided in matters of conduct by the deliveries of their own uninstructed consciences. For, after all, the rule of man's conduct is written in his own heart. Neither Catholicism nor any other form of Christianity pretends to have a special morality of its own. Religion is meant to enforce, not to supersede, the natural code of morals. Christianity, for example, forbids suicide, but then, so did Plato. Ideally, the perfect pagan should interpret his moral duties exactly as a Christian would. But within the last 50 years or so, an open challenge has been issued to traditional morality in matters concerning sex. A steady, ceaseless howl of literary propaganda has shaken the faith of our generation in the indissolubility of marriage, hitherto conceived as a principle of natural morality. Let anyone contrast Jane Eyre with the average modern novel, and he will see how far our thought has traveled. Half a century ago it was assumed, even in more or less free-thinking circles, that divorce was a disreputable subject, and that remarriage after divorce was a disqualification for respectable society. Today, such principles are maintained among Christians only with hesitation, among freethinkers not at all. Within the last few years a second challenge has been issued, by a less open, but not less formidable propaganda, against the fruitfulness of marriage. Practices hitherto connected with the unmentioned underworld of society have found their way into the home. Once again, it is not merely a Christian principle that has been thrown overboard. It is a point over which Jewish moralists are no less definite than our own, Ovid and Juvenal, with no flicker of Christian revelation to guide them, branded the practices in question with a protest of heathen satire. It is not Christian morality, but natural morality as hitherto conceived, that has been outraged by the change of standard. Now, the healthier part of our fellow citizens does not want to see the effects of either propaganda carried to their logical conclusion. No decent person wants free love. No decent person wants race suicide. They live, therefore, not by principle, but by a compromise between principles. They are in favor of divorce, but not of easy divorce, of small families, but not of too small families. Consequently, they feel themselves responsible for the decision where exactly the line shall be drawn, within the generous limits which our legal system allows, they do not like the responsibility, would, in tampering with institutions so sacred as those of the family, would not like to feel that he had an authority behind him, a warrant from somewhere to ratify his behavior. If only there were some great spiritual institution which would act, in these matters, as a sort of public conscience, guiding, from a higher point of vision, the moral choice made by the individual. So, naturally, he feels, unfortunately, he does not feel, that the views of any non-Catholic denomination are worth having, even if they are discoverable. He knows that the advice of an individual clergyman will be unofficial and inexpert. He knows, if he has followed the course of recent ecclesiastical deliberations, that representatives of Christian thought speak with an uncertain voice on such subjects. He respects our church for having, at least, definite opinions and fixed rules. He respects it, although he disagrees with it. He thinks us far too severe in forbidding remarriage after divorce, in forbidding the artificial restriction of the family, but although he disagrees with us for the rules we have, he respects us for having rules. If only the people whom we value as advisors would give us the advice we want. Moral hesitations chiefly affect the young. Intellectual hesitations are commonly put off until they reach an age when the mind has become more reflective, and, alas, less adventurous. It is the chief tragedy of life that, whereas logically thought should precede action, in the development of man's career action precedes thought. Men are becoming middle-aged, with families growing up, and asking the eternal questions of youth, feel an ill-defined gap in their minds, if they have no creed to live by, and are apt to take more notice of what the religious world is doing. They can hardly become attentive to its symptoms today without recognizing, and being disturbed by, the chaos of religious sentiment which I made some attempt to describe in the foregoing chapter. They see how rapidly the fashions of thought are changing, how landmarks of tradition have been removed even within their own lifetime. They are conscious that even their own hesitating infidelities, the vogue of their youth, are becoming fact numbers, as fresh thoughts and fresh heresies crowd them out. The reaction from this constant flux of innovation disposes their minds, I will not say towards the idea of certitude, but towards the idea of fixity in religious beliefs. To be told, by optimistic clerical friends, that the present age is only a period of transition, and that in 20 or 30 years' time a clearer perception of spiritual truths is bound to emerge, is hardly consoling to them. They think of their gray hairs, and wonder whether they will live to see it. For that matter, the clerical optimist has been saying the same thing steadily these 100 years past. Is it wonderful, if they sometimes listen, to catch the whisper of an authoritative voice? They do not, as a rule, want authority in matters of belief for the right reason I point e, that the whole notion of a revealed religion becomes logically impossible without it. They do not understand that the whole edifice of non-Catholic theology has always been doomed to wreck, because it never had any foundation in reason. But they do see that, here and now, there is no tradition so long established that it cannot be questioned, no doctrine so venerable that it cannot be controverted. They do see that the leaders of Protestant thought are desperately guessing at the truth, and covering up their uncertainties with equivocal phrases and sentimental whitewash. Really, the sight of it would almost make you want to be a Roman Catholic, if the Roman Catholics did not believe such impossible things. The instinct for beauty, the instinct for mystery, the instinct for naturalness, the instinct for history, the instinct for worldwide citizenship, the instinct for moral guidance, the instinct for intellectual definiteness, all these, or any of these, may make a man, do make many men, look towards the Catholic Church, if not with less reprobation, at least with more interest, if not with less ignorance, at least with more curiosity. Some wish they could become Catholics, some wish they had been born Catholics, some content themselves with saying that it must be very nice to be a Catholic. If only they could tell the first lie as someone has put it, how easily all the rest would follow. 3. Telling the first lie. That phrase about telling the first lie is a particularly revealing one. It reveals not the attitude of Catholics towards religious truth, but the ignorance of non-Catholics about the religion of their fellow countrymen. I shall be accused, perhaps, of a sulky querulousness, when I say this. It will be conjectured that I'm revenging myself on those who do not agree with me by pretending that they do not understand me. But it is true, and it is a truth which becomes more luminous the more you come in contact with the public attitude towards Catholics, that the English people, when it talks about the Catholic Church, loses all sense of reality, of human possibilities.